Yesterday we were looking at the philosophy of Jean-Paul Sartre, continuing our discussion that began with phenomenology, a consideration of the consciousness of the subject of knower of knowing, looking at the inner character of man, if you will, and that led us into existentialism. We had occasion to look at the work of Heidegger. And as I began my words on Sartre, following after Heidegger, I was in a hurry to get going and I didn't give you any biographical sketch. And so let me just real quickly go back and fill that in and then we'll continue on the thought of Sartre. Sartre's dates are 1905 to 1980. He studied at the Sorbonne and Göttingen under Husserl. During World War II, he was part of the resistance against Hitler, and after the war became a leader among left-wing intellectuals in Paris. He was the co-founder of the well-known periodical Les Temps Modernes, Modern Times. Sartre professed Marxism for a while, was a member of the Communist Party, but even after leaving the Communist Party, continued to profess to Marxism. One thing that is perhaps unique about Sartre as a philosopher is that he's a literary figure. He wrote novels and plays as well as works of philosophy, and in a sense, you get his philosophy almost equally from whether you read the literary side of his output or the philosophical side of his output. He gives something of a autobiographical novel in the work entitled Nausea, 1938. But he comes and gives a straightforward autobiography that also explains his attitude toward language and the work that he does as a writer and philosopher in the 1963 book Words. A couple of plays that he wrote that you should be able to identify, because in terms of 20th century culture, they're important. I don't want you to be illiterate, cultural illiterates when you get done. So you want to remember the title, The Flies, and the other one, No Exit, which is a kind of a dialogue in hell. From which there is no exit. Perhaps one of the best known aphorisms in all of Sartre's writings comes from No Exit, where he says, hell is other people. And when you understand the nature of existentialist thought, I mean, that's such a really brilliant insight, because the whole point is that other people are free in defining their own essence, then they stand in the way, you know, theoretically, if not practically, in the way of my total freedom. And so hell is, when all is said and done, the fact that there are other people trying to make themselves God out there as well as myself. In terms of his philosophical output, the two works, he wrote a lot, but the two works that you should keep in mind, the essay Existentialism is a Humanism. Existentialism is a Humanism, 1946. But the massive work that preceded that was entitled Being and Nothingness, Being and Nothingness, 1943. Yesterday I tried to give you the flavor of Sartre's existentialism by starting with the quotation that metaphysics is not a barren discussion of abstract notions that escape experience. Sartre's not interested in something that's out there, that's not particular, that doesn't have anything to do with his experience or man's experience, but more particularly his as an individual. Metaphysics, engaging in the traditional task of philosophy, it must be a living effort to embrace the human condition from inside. We need to have a subjective approach. We need to see the world through our own eyes to understand the human condition and to respond to it. It must be a living effort to deal with that. And just as our time was ending, I was explaining that existentialism is a philosophy that's primarily ethical in orientation. There's a lot of discussion of what man is, being and nothingness. These look like, if you will, metaphysical type discussions, but they really aren't. When all is said and done, Sartre's discussions are for the sake of how we should live our lives. So ethical in motivation and in general character. Sartre extols the virtues of authenticity, talks about legitimate anguish, disdains what he calls bad faith, which is an attempt to escape from your freedom, what you have as a human being. For Sartre, when you look at the human situation, there's both appropriate and reprehensible kinds of behavior. We need to understand who we are and how we should live. Sartre affirmed, and I quote, "The subject of literature has always been man in the world." So when he wrote as a novelist or as a playwright, the focus, even as in his existential philosophy, must be on man in the world, not on abstract, bloodless, unliving concepts, but who am I, where am I, what am I supposed to do? According to Sartre, in true literature, being is calling out to man. Of course, who's he aping when he said that? Heidegger, of course. Being speaks to us in literature. The stress is on the character of the individual. The stress is on his behavior. Now, this brings us already, I think you can begin to see a contradiction in Sartre. I'll develop it more as we talk. But Sartre, and just the way that he writes and the way he sets forth his characters and what he says in his philosophy, on the one hand wants to be very individualistic, but on the other hand wants to say there are things people ought to do. He wants people to disdain bad faith. He wants them to live authentically. But the problem is, if living authentically means being true to my individuality, then why should I listen to you tell me to live authentically? I'm an individual. I'm not bound to you. Hell is other people. To put it very simply, hell is Jean-Paul Sartre telling me what to do. So there's this inner contradiction in existentialism from the very outset. When Sartre writes, he gives a real sense of the discontinuity of reality, and you feel the despair of his characters. The very style of writing reflects the existentialist, you know, brooding anxiety or angst about how do we live in this world? Doesn't any of this make sense? Who am I? Sartre said, in his work, What is Literature? And I'm quoting, "The aim of literature is to communicate, to impart to others the results one has obtained. As I talk, I reveal the situation. I reveal it to myself and others in order to change it." Now think about that. I reveal the situation to myself and others. You see, when he writes at this point in his life, the book is What is Literature, Sartre still has the idea that communication is possible. There's enough of essence, if you will, enough of universality that communication makes sense. You can presuppose that. I write to reveal to myself and to others something. And, of course, it has the existential practical end in order to change the world and to change the human condition. It's true. But in 1963, when Sartre wrote his autobiography, The Words, he reveals his bitter skepticism regarding the all-powerful character of words, that mandate of literature, I write to reveal. Okay? Now he wants to become more seriously and consistently an existentialist. The book indicates that although he had given up, as he says, the Father and the Son of Christian theology, apparently the Holy Spirit had managed to get a grip on him and inspire him with false ideas about a special priesthood of literature. And so at the end of the book, we see the bleak despair characteristic of existential thought now in Sartre's new conception of literature itself. And this is his cold affirmation. I quote him, "I have changed. I collared the Holy Spirit in the cellar and threw him out. Atheism is a cruel and long-range affair. I think I've carried it through. I've given up the office, the priesthood, but not the frock. I still write. What else can I do? It's a habit, and besides, it's my profession. For a long time, I took my pen for a sword. I now know we're powerless. No matter. I write and will keep writing books. They're needed. All the same, they do serve some purpose. Culture doesn't save anything or anyone. It doesn't justify. But it's a product of man. He projects himself into it. He recognizes himself in it. That critical mirror alone offers him his image." Man, I mean, that is just, those are powerful words of confession, it seems to me. In the first place, Sartre is admitting, when I thought that there was a priesthood, if you will, to at least literature, that I'm trying to express myself, I can reveal myself, I wasn't carrying through my atheism. Because if I am true to my atheism, there can't be any meaning in literature either. There can be no revelation from one person to another either. And so literature is absurd. My getting, if you will, these high and mighty, highfalutin ideas that I can communicate to people and help the human situation, that doesn't fit an atheist view of the universe. But then turning back on himself and again showing his existential character, even though he said literature is absurd, I still do it. What else can I do? Here I am in an absurd situation. He says, but at least in literature, I project an image of myself, and so literature is like a mirror for me. So I can recognize myself in the mirror. Please note the despair, then, of a man-centered philosophy like existentialism. Here's Sartre trying more and more and more to be consistent to his atheism. And, you know, he's on the way to seeing, if he didn't actually see and then have to turn back from it, he's on his way to seeing that if you really carry out the project of atheism, you shouldn't even talk. Literature, communication makes no sense. It already assumes some kind of universality and some kind of meaning, some kind of project in this world that is not your own. If you're going to be a really severe individualist, the only thing that I know is that I exist, there is no God, and I'll make who I will be, then you don't even need to write. This reminds me of Nietzsche, who, as you remember, tried to carry through his atheism too, and that led him to the view that there really is no getting back to the original text of reality. There's only interpretations. There are no absolute values. God doesn't exist. You've got to create your own values. And as he's thinking about this, Nietzsche writes one day that he fears that we really haven't given up our atheism because we still believe in grammar. Okay, so this confession by Sartre, you might want to tie into Nietzsche's observation as well. As long as people are using language, even if you want to look in Nietzsche's case at such a minimal thing as grammar, there are rules, which means there are universals that you're applying. In Sartre's case, the use of words to reveal showed that I still hadn't given up the Trinity. I had at least the Holy Spirit, if you will, giving me a vocation, a purpose for living, a project to be involved in. But atheism, if carried out, it's a nasty task and would finally end to utter silence. Well, maybe this is a good place now to go back and let's have a more technical look at his philosophy itself. We've just mentioned silence. Remember that he wrote a massive book for which he gained quite a reputation entitled Being and Nothingness. The doctrine of nothingness or negation is crucial to Sartrean existentialism, especially crucial to his account of what freedom is. Sartre feels that the very posing of the ontological question, what exists, what is being, immediately leads to a confrontation with nothingness. Let me quote him. What being will be must of necessity arise on the basis of what is not. Whatever being is, it will allow this formulation. Being is that, and outside that, nothing. Thus, a new component of the real has just appeared to us, non-being. Okay, so if we want to know what being is, we automatically have got to introduce into our thinking non-being, against which we define being. Truth must be not being. What is truth? Is truth being or not being? Well, truth is not being. How come? Well, for a couple reasons. First, truth is always about being, what exists. When you tell the truth, you're speaking about something that exists, that has being. And so, since you're talking about being when you speak the truth, then truth is something other than being. That puts it in the category of non-being or not being. And since truth always involves distinctions and limitations, but being itself is an undivided unity, a plenum, then truth cannot be being. You with me? Now, I think there's a lot of, again, my analytical prejudices come through. I think there's a lot of nonsense playing on words and puns and slippery expression here. But, I mean, we can play this game. It's kind of fun, okay? So, you have being, but you can't have being without not being. Now, since truth is about being and draws distinctions, then it cannot be being. And so, truth is not being. Now, the origin of nothingness presents a paradox. Being cannot give rise to non-being, and sheer nothingness isn't. So has no power to annihilate being in order to create its own non-being. So where do we get nothingness? Sartre concludes there must be a third kind of thing out there. In addition to being and nothingness, there must be a third type of thing to discuss. Now, are you with me? Don't fall off because it's early in the morning here now. You can follow this. Being doesn't create non-being, and nothing, since it is nothing, can't create itself, so we have to have something third, which can produce nothingness. The nothingness must be within itself and non-derived, or else we don't have an explanation for nothingness. And therefore, and I quote, the being by which nothingness comes to the world must be its own nothingness. And so if we're going to be able to account for nothingness, there must be a being which is nothingness that can give rise to that nothingness. There must be something that exists that has within it non-being. This being, which is its own nothingness, is human reality or human consciousness. Human reality has being which has nothingness embedded in it. In order to be this, man must have, or as Sartre likes to put it, man must be his own freedom. And Sartre's theory of freedom is foundational to his ethical vision. According to him, freedom is identified with human reality. Indeed, freedom constitutes human reality. Man is freedom. In Sartre's literary trilogy, the first installment is The Age of Reason. And on the last page of that novel, we read, Matthew thought, I remain alone, alone but no freer than before. No one has interfered with my freedom. My life has drained it dry. Much ado about nothing, he thought. For nothing. This life had been given him for nothing. He was nothing, and yet he would not change. Now, when we get to the reprieve, which is the second in the literary trilogy, Matthew is a soldier in the war, realizing that his life lies wasted behind him with no hope of being retrieved. He comes to recognize that his difficulties reside solely within himself. But now the war has swooped down and crushed his future to nothing. The question pressing upon him is, what is this self to which he had so obstinately been clinging? And the answer is nothing. He comes to perceive that the freedom he had sought was to be found within himself, and he mutters, I am my own freedom. Now this means that man must be distant from the world, conceived of as being in itself. He must be able to detach himself from the world that is just in itself being. In the novel Nausea, Antoine Requentin, the central figure, approximates this kind of detachment when he stands back and away to observe. And then all of a sudden, there it was, clear as day. Existence had suddenly unveiled itself. It had the lost, harmless look of an abstract category. It was the very paste of things. This veneer had melted, leaving soft, monstrous masses all in disorder, naked and frightful, obscene nakedness. We need to stand back from being in itself, distance ourselves. And now this ability to other the world, to be other than being in itself, to distance yourself from the world, that ability to negate the world is freedom. Now, because we started early this morning, many of you are having to drink coffee to stay awake and so forth. You're fighting being in itself, the conditions under which you are living. Now, when you are able to negate the conditions of being in itself, to fight against just the circumstances, you're being free, right? You're all demonstrating your freedom in that you say, I came to class today, I didn't sleep in. And so the demands of my body and whatever may have kept me in, but I am a free person. So you are negating being, and that is your freedom. Man is the source of distinction and limitation. That is, man is the source of the truth. Whenever I say something, I'm drawing a distinction within being in itself. So I'm the source of those distinctions. But since it's something which is not true to being in itself, it's a nothingness, I am able, as a being, to engage in nothingness. I can negate the world, and I can draw distinctions in the plenum of being. So man is not being in itself. We're not just rocks, you know. We aren't just things, we make decisions. We have freedom. And that being the case, man is a whole in being, Sartre says. Man is a nothing. Well, that's interesting. So now Sartre has shown that man, which is, which exists, man has being, but man also is the source of nothing. And his freedom is what makes him the source of nothing. He is the being that has nothingness within him, or the power of nothingness within him. Sartre offers the clearest summary of this, I think, in the following passage from Being and Nothingness. And I want to warn you, this is a long block quote, so please pay attention. He says, human reality is its own nothingness. For the for itself, and now I didn't explain this, did I? You have two types of being, in itself, for itself being. In itself is, just think of rocks, okay? Rocks are just rocks. They're in and of themselves rocks, that's it. But human beings are not in and of themselves something. Human beings are for themselves something. They have projects. They make decisions. They are free. They have purposes. So they are for itself, not in itself. Now let me go back. Human reality is its own nothingness. For the for itself to be is to annihilate the in itself, which it is. I guess I do have to give commentary before I'm going to finish this. Okay. Your freedom amounts to your ability to annihilate your in itself being. I'm going to do it right now. See, I'm a college teacher in the state of South Carolina, but you know what I'm thinking about? Being a surfer in Hawaii. Now, what am I in itself? In itself, you know where my body is and what I'm doing. But I just had the freedom to other myself. So the in itself was destroyed by the for itself. My freedom to be something for something else, my freedom to think, it's not true, but to imagine, put a hole in the being that I actually am. Isn't that great? And people call this philosophy. Anyway, for the for itself to be is to annihilate the in itself, which it is. Under these conditions, freedom can be nothing other than this annihilation. It is through this that the for itself, that is human reality, escapes its being as its essence. It is through this that the for itself is always something other than that what can be said of it. For in the final analysis, the for itself is the one which escapes this denomination, the one which is already beyond the name which is given to it, beyond the property which is recognized in it. That is, you can't capture me, you can't define me and turn me into an object. I'm free, I'm a for itself. To say that the for itself has to be what it is, to say that it is what it is not, to say that in it existence precedes and conditions essence, all this is to say one and the same thing, to be aware that man is free. Now, part of that I want you to write down. To say that existence precedes essence. Existence precedes essence is to say man is free. I am condemned to exist forever beyond my essence, beyond the causes and motives of my act. I am condemned to be free. This means that no limits to my freedom can be found except freedom itself, or if you prefer, that we are not free to cease being free. Freedom in its foundation coincides with the nothingness which is at the heart of man. Human reality is free because it is not enough. That's the end of the long quote. Now, do you have a sense of what he's saying here? Existence precedes essence. What if someone were to say, well, now, who are you? What are you? I'm asking after your essence, right? What are you like? What kind of person are you? And Sartre says, you don't come into this world with an essence. That is, nothing has predefined you. and you don't live in this world as an in itself, you know, just an essence that can't, you know, be beyond what it is. So that in this world, no one can tell you who you must be, how you must live. No one can define your life for you. Your parents can't define your life for you. God can't define your life for you. The church can't define your life for you. The state can't define your life for you. Your boss can't define your life for you. Your husband or your wife can't define your life for you. No one can take away your inner reality, which is to be a for itself. You exist, and only after you get that you exist, you have being, a special kind of being. And after that, you determine what your essence will be. Now, this is fancy language for stuff you've probably heard in pop psychology and pop culture all the time. No one can tell you who to be. You be who you are. Be true to yourself. That's kind of what Sartre's saying here. He's saying you exist, and then you choose what your essence will be. Existence precedes essence. Now, in his little essay, Existentialism is a Humanism, which I still think is the best place to go if you're going to read something on what existentialism is. It's short, and it's fairly understandable, I think. This is what he says. Existentialism comes down to existence precedes essence, right? Existence. You can see it in the name itself. You first have being. You exist. You don't first have an essence, as though God thought about you, you know, and then finally created you, or that God's molding you into some idea of what you will be. There is no God, and so you don't have an essence. And you're not subject to, you know, the freedom of other people. I mean, you're not subordinated to the freedom of other people, your parents, your teachers, the police, whoever it might be. You exist, and you freely choose your essence. Sartre says we are free from our passions. That's why he doesn't like psychological schools that say, like Freudianism, you know, there are all these deep forces down there in the subconscious that are controlling you. Sartre says, no, nothing takes away your freedom. Because if there were those deep forces, subconscious forces, then you wouldn't be a for itself. You'd be an object. You'd be an in itself. Sartre says you're free to follow your passions or to resist your passions. So obviously your passions don't control you. You're free from motives. You're free from being in itself. Nothing in the world out there, objects in the world, part of the causal process, can force you to be something. And you're free from essence. So let me quote from that essay. What is meant by saying that existence precedes essence? It means that first of all, man exists, turns up, appears on the scene, and only afterwards defines himself. If man, as the existentialist conceives him, is indefinable, it is because at first he is nothing. Only afterward will he be something, and he himself will have made what he will be. Thus there is no human nature, since there is no God to conceive it. Not only is man what he conceives himself to be, but he is also only what he will himself to be after this thrust toward existence. Man is nothing else but what he makes of himself. Such is the first principle of existentialism. Man's choice as a free agent, that is, since he's a nothing which has being, man's choice as a free agent defines himself as he goes along. And man is always free to choose any new essence he wishes, because there is no nature to man or defining characteristic prior to his existence as a choosing individual that can decide what he will be. Only he can decide what he will be. When people say, well, no, I was forced to do this, Sartre said, well, then you chose to let that, you know, be forced upon you. Now that means that there can be no values that precede man that would define him or guide him. There can be no antecedent values. And so he says, I'm quoting, the existentialist thinks it is very distressing that God does not exist, because all possibility of finding values in a heaven of ideas disappears along with him. Dostoevsky said, if God didn't exist, everything would be possible. This is the very starting point of existentialism, and as a result, man is forlorn, because neither within himself nor without does he find anything to cling to. The existentialist says, there are no values that define us, so my freedom is my despair. I have no guidance in this world. Every choice is as justifiable as well as absurd as any other choice, because in a world where there are no predefined values, there can be no justification one way or another for what you do. The very standards in terms of which a choice could be justified would have to logically precede the choice. But as Sartre said, nothing precedes my existence that defines what I am or what I should be. And so the crux of Sartre's ethical doctrine lies in this view that human reality is not bound by any pre-established values. Human reality is absolutely free. There are no values that define us. This is probably the most radical doctrine of freedom that's ever been formulated in the history of philosophy. In The Age of Reason, the novel The Age of Reason, Matthew, now a philosophy teacher at the Lycee, insists, and I quote, I am because I will. It's my decision, my willing, that gives me existence. But it's the protagonist of The Flies who is the epitome of Sartre's self-determining man. Orestes looks upon himself as the instrument of fate because he's destined to overthrow the gods and determined to avenge his father's death. Orestes is dangerous because he realizes that he is free. And the thesis of the play is that such a man as Orestes can shape his own destiny. Orestes believes that by virtue of his discovery of true freedom and power over Zeus, that he is or has become a savior of mankind. Justice is man-made as he sees it, so he feels no remorse in killing the king who had killed his father. He declares that the fatal blunder of Zeus was to make man free because that deed cannot be undone. Let me give you two revealing quotes from the protagonist, Orestes. One is, I am my freedom. And then the other is, I am doomed to have no other law but mine. Doomed to have no other law but mine. See, there's a great anxiety. There's a great angst about this. I have nothing to guide me. So that's my freedom is my greatness, but it's also my doom. There's nothing. How do I know how to use my freedom? Nobody can help me, because that would assume what? An essence that my existence is subordinate to. But I exist first. I make my own essence. No one else does. So I'm radically free. That's why, by the way, in No Exit, Sartre can say, with all these radically free people around, hell is other people. An obvious example of Sartre's doctrine that values do not exist because God does not exist is recorded in The Devil and the Good Lord, which is his most overtly religious work. And I quote, on this earth and at this time, good and evil are inseparable. I am willing to be evil in order to become good. God does not exist. No more heaven, no more hell. The earth alone remains. Away with monsters, away with saints, away with pride. There is nothing but men. So this radical freedom and autonomy that's being pushed by Sartre is nicely reflected again in The Age of Reason, where Matthew now says, he could do what he liked. No one had the right to advise him. There would be for him no good nor evil unless he brought them into being. That's existentialism. Radical freedom. First, there's something prima facie troublesome about this doctrine of absolute freedom, isn't there? Am I really absolutely free? Now, Sartre's not so stupid as to not recognize there are obstacles in the way of my doing some things, okay? I get done with this class, I'd like to hurry back to my room, and I say, I think I'll fly. Well, I'm not free to fly. Sartre says, however, your inability to fly is only an obstacle to you because what? Because you chose to go back to your room via that mode of transportation. It's only your choosing to fly that your inability to fly that makes your inability to fly an obstacle. And so in a sense, even the obstacles in my life are obstacles only because of my choices. And so freedom is still greater than those obstacles. Well, you know, that's a clever little play with words. But as a matter of fact, I did not choose the relationship between the laws of gravity and the physical dynamics that account for my inability to fly. I didn't choose those conditions. So the fact that those conditions are thwarting me does come from my free choice to try to do something I can't do. But that doesn't really answer the problem. I still have obstacles that are not of my choice. So his doctrine of freedom, just to take a real blunt and easy illustration, is rather counterintuitive. I think most of us say, well, I mean, that's just not right. It's just incorrect. But what I want you to see about his doctrine of freedom is that according to Sartre, absolute freedom implies absolute responsibility. To quote him, the